Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA as we travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we are at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center, where Alaska's senior senator, Lisa Murkowski, is addressing the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. Recorded on Monday, August 31st, Senator Lisa Murkowski, speaking on the impacts of congressional action on the economy, is coming up next on KSKA after the news.
I'd like to go ahead and begin, and I'd first like to welcome everybody here to today's Make It Monday Forum. My name is Phil Okeson. I'm chair of the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce Board of Directors and chief financial officer of Northern Air Cargo. We've got a lot of ground to cover today, so let's get started. Natural resource development, the state's economy, and healthcare reform are just some of the issues facing Alaskans and business owners in 2009. But how are these being handled by lawmakers in Washington? U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski is here today to discuss the impact of congressional action on the state's economy and will discuss her upcoming priorities for Alaska in 2010. During today's presentation, we will ask you not to interrupt during the presentation. We are going to do as we traditionally do and have questions written down on slips of paper. So you should find on everybody's table slips of paper, and if you could just write down your questions and raise your hand with the question, and one of our staff members will come by, pick it up, and we'll try to get to as many questions as we possibly can before the end of today's session. And any question that we don't get to, the senator's staff has graciously said that they will answer them on the senator's website afterwards. Now let's get started with today's presentation. Senator Lisa Murkowski is the first Alaska-born senator to serve in the state and the sixth U.S. senator from Alaska, born in Ketchikan. Since joining the Senate in 2002, Senator Murkowski has advocated for improving the state of healthcare, education, energy, veterans affairs, and infrastructure development in Alaska. Earlier this year, Senator Murkowski became the top Republican on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee and won a coveted seat on the Senate Appropriations Committee. In June 2009, Senator Murkowski was elected by her peers to be a member of the Republican Senate leadership team. In addition to her tenure in the United States Senate, Senator Murkowski was elected to three terms in the Alaska State House of Representatives beginning in 1998. Senator Murkowski is married to Vern Martell, and they have two sons, Nicholas and Matthew. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Senator Lisa Murkowski.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you. I sit here and most of you have your backs to the window, but what a phenomenal view, what a phenomenal day. It's so great to be home. I was woken up before the alarm clock this morning by a flock of honking geese that was going overhead. My fingers are still stained from blueberry picking yesterday, and it's just a reminder that there is no better place that we can live. There is no better place that we can raise our families than in a place like Alaska. So it's important that we talk about kind of what the impact is on all of us, what the impact is on our families, from what's going on in Congress, what's happening with the national economy, and just kind of the lay of the land back there and how it impacts us here in the North. I want to recognize, though, there's a lot of discussion about what Congress is doing or what the president is doing to make our economy strong, and I am absolutely fervent in my belief that it's not us in the Congress. It's people like you. It's the people that are here in this room, in this state, those that are working every day to build your businesses, provide for your families. That's the backbone of our economy. That's what makes us strong here. So whether you're in the fisheries, whether you're in the tourism industry or the construction industry or the oil and gas industry, this is where it really all comes together. And it really is through our collective efforts here that our economy will rise and will fall. Now, we know that there are clearly ways that our government can work to help facilitate getting our economy on sound footing. But really, when you think about it, the best thing that we can be doing for you back in Washington, D.C., is making sure that you all have the tools that you need to succeed in your own endeavors and allow the entrepreneurship to thrive. Now, we've been kind of moving away from doing that, giving you all the tools, and instead, we've really, as a country, I think as a government, we've been moving to allow for the government to provide for the fix. And look what we did with the automobile manufacturing. You know, when the government comes in and takes an ownership share in automobile manufacturing, did we give them the tools for entrepreneurship? Are we really setting them up to thrive? I'm not convinced. There's some other things that have been going on that I think have raised more than a share of eyebrows. We had a big push earlier this year in January and going into February. The big push was we have to have an economic stimulus package for this country. We have to have it yesterday. And by the way, if we don't push an $800 billion plus economic stimulus, we may see unemployment rise to as high as 8%. Well, we moved through a $787 billion economic stimulus plan, and lo and behold, we're not shoving the money out the door as fast as they said that we needed to, and by the way, we're at about 9.5% unemployment. I had some issues with the stimulus bill and the direction, I guess, that we took as a nation in terms of kind of just taking a whole bunch of money, putting it in an airplane and kind of cramming it out the door and hoping that it was going to land someplace that was going to make some difference. And, you know, in fairness, there are some real benefits that we have seen to that economic stimulus money. But as I'm talking to folks around the country, as I'm talking to folks in Alaska, there's a lot of concern about, was that really wisely spent? Is that giving us the stimulus that we need? I had said all along, I think that there's a better way to be doing it. If, in fact, the government needs to step in and needs to provide some direct dollars, why aren't we doing more to facilitate the infrastructure projects, the projects that you know put people to work right away? You know, you see all the orange cones out there on the roads, and you know people are working right away. But it's not only those short-term jobs. It's really what happens in terms of that long-term economic development, that infrastructure that's going to be with us for a period of time. So again, it goes back to my early point of let's give individuals the tools that they need, give the private sector the tools and the resources to survive and thrive. Now, when it comes to what's going on in Congress right now with helping to facilitate our transportation infrastructure, I think it's clear it's not just here in Alaska, but our transportation infrastructure around the nation is not equipped to handle the demands that we see coming over these next several years as hopefully our economy does rebound and we see global trade increase. We've got study after study that tells us, you know, this is the direction it's going to go. But what we need to be doing is looking to how we build out our transportation infrastructure investments and really how we're going to pay for them in a responsible manner. We have the current service transportation program. This is scheduled to expire at the end of next month. We know that it needs to be extended. There's some debate going on right now as to how long that extension of the current program will be. In the end, I think what we're going to see is about an 18-month extension. We may have to wait and see if that is, in fact, the case. But that's one aspect where you think about our federal policies and what happens in Washington, D.C., and what the impact, the implication can be for here in Alaska. Another area, most certainly, and I know as I'm looking out at the room here, a lot of folks associated with the energy industry. And we know that this is one area where Congress can play a productive role. I don't need to give you the statistics. I think we're all very familiar with them. I was up in Chena Hot Springs, I guess it was last weekend, at the Renewable Energy Fair up there. And we're reminded there that the United States is the most energy-consuming country in the world, and Alaska is the most energy-consuming state in the country. Right now, Alaskans are paying, on average, about 12% of their household income for energy. It's about four times the national average, but out in some of our rural communities, they're close to 50% of their household income that is spent on energy. Absolutely, positively unsustainable. And then from a business perspective, when you look at what is happening with your energy costs and the concerns that we're facing here in South Central with dwindling supplies coming out of Cook Inlet, great deal of concern about, are we going to be in a situation in maybe not this next winter, but the following winter, where we, the state's largest city, the South Central area, is going to be experiencing brownouts? You know, are we prepared? Are we moving forward with a plan? But if you're a business, it's pretty darn difficult to be competitive at current energy costs. Certainly very hard for individuals and their families as they look to their utility bills, their fuel bills. So, a lot going on in Congress right now when it comes to energy. When we go back in next week, clearly the hottest topic is health care reform, but right on its heels is the issue of climate change and a cap and trade bill. I'll mention more about that in detail in just a couple minutes here, but you know, it's not just cap and trade that we have out there that we need to be concerned about. Whether it's health care reform or whatever the next initiative is coming out of the Congress or the administration, the real question is how do you pay for it? Well, unfortunately, the industry that seems to have the biggest bullseye on it is the oil and gas industry. And it's like, well, you know, if we just take a little bit here, take a little bit there, we can fund this. This is an ongoing fight that we face when we're talking about energy and the potential for energy tax hikes. I want to just take a minute here before I move into some of the big gorillas that are out there in the energy world that we'll be facing. We advanced an energy bill through the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, moved it out of committee in June. It was described by one individual as the longest, most torturous committee markup that they had ever seen. It went on and on and on. And then they said, but it was so good. And it was so good because we actually allowed the committee process to work. We put drafts out there weeks ahead of time so that members could take a look at them. I worked with Senator Bingham and the chairman on the committee, and we had agreed that there were certain titles that, hey, this wasn't Republican, this wasn't Democrat, this just made good sense. Let's sign on to it. Let's work it. And there was a great deal of collaboration that went into it. But then on those things that we didn't agree to, everyone was free to offer their amendments. And there were hundreds of amendments. And we went through them, and we had honest-to-goodness debate in a committee. And believe it or not, there were some, in fact, there were actually many, where we didn't know whether we were going to win or we were going to lose, because the debate actually worked. We would have colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle who are, you know, they're coming from coal-producing states saying, wait a minute, you know, this is crazy for my state. And it was a true bipartisan product at the end of the process. Now, there's some stuff in it that, quite honestly, I don't like. I don't like at all. But it was a product of a committee that was even-handed and balanced. Now, there were some disappointments. I think you already know we weren't successful in getting the ANWR provision in, even a greatly scaled back ANWR provision. That's always a disappointment, but that doesn't mean that we give up on it. We did permit some more offshore oil development in the eastern Gulf of Mexico, allowed for the tapping of an area called the Destin Dome. This is off of the coast of Florida. This is good dry gas that they estimate should produce about 3 trillion cubic feet of gas almost overnight. So in terms of reducing our reliance in an area that is relatively easy to gain access to, I mean, this was good. And I'll tell you, I had some of my colleagues say, wow, never thought that we were actually going to get some production out of an energy bill. Well, it's not as much production as we would have liked, but it was a help. We won approval for combined federal permitting, the Federal Permitting Office for OCS development off the coast, off of Alaska here. Hopefully to reduce some of the red tape that companies like Shell and some of the others have been facing as they're looking to go into the Beaufort and the Chukchi. Things like OCS royalty sharing, we weren't successful in, but we haven't given up on that. I've got legislation in that I have introduced that would allow for revenue sharing, and that's one of the issues that will be before us on the floor. It'll be a good floor fight. But I tell you, I think we're making some real headway on that issue. As people look to what's happening here in this country and our reliance, and they're seeing what the possibility can be for us as a nation offshore. You know, it wasn't just more than a couple weeks ago that the administration went ahead and said, yeah, offshore of Brazil is good, and they helped to facilitate a loan through the Export-Import Bank. Well, if it's good enough for Brazil, please tell me why it's not good enough off of our shores. So we're going to keep pushing on that. We also got some amendments in the energy bill to raise the loan guarantee for our Alaska Natural Gas Line to $30 billion. It was at an $18 billion cap. We allow the Federal Financing Bank to make the guarantee. Hopefully this will result in lower interest rates, saving potentially millions in financing charges. There were also some provisions that make the guarantee work better. So things to help facilitate what we're doing here in Alaska. I mentioned there were some things in the bill that didn't particularly gain my support. One is a renewable electricity standard. It's not so onerous for a state like Alaska, but when you come from a part of the country that is limited in terms of the renewable energy sources that are out there, and we don't count nuclear. For instance, the South decided years ago they didn't have much in terms of their renewable energy resources. They invested in nuclear. And now when we're talking about, well, we need to move towards carbon-free emissions, somehow or other, nuclear doesn't count in that equation, something that I find amazing. I find even more incredible the fact that we got such pushback on the definition of hydropower to be included as a renewable resource. I told him, I said, I was born in Ketchikan, Alaska. It's a rainforest. There's nothing more renewable than that rain that keeps pouring down and the hydropower that we have there. So we were successful in getting a definition included in this RES that does include Alaska Lake Tap. It would include the smaller projects. It would include Lake Chacachamna, which is, as we know around here, has great potential for us in the South Central region. So we've got an energy bill out there that has not yet advanced. The suggestion from the majority leader was that we don't want to move an energy bill until we have the cap and trade piece. The cap and trade piece has jurisdiction from multiple committees. Most primarily, however, it would be the Environment and Public Works Committee. The majority leader has tasked the committees of jurisdiction to come up with their proposals on a cap and trade by the 28th of September, and then everything would come together and we'd figure out what it's going to look like. Well, Senator Boxer, who's chairman of the EPW committee, has pretty much said she's going to use the cap and trade bill that the House moved through as kind of her base bill. Ladies and gentlemen, if we have that in front of us, any version or iteration of what the House advanced, it is not only disastrous for the state of Alaska, but I think it is just frightening for our country. I want to work to reduce emissions. I absolutely believe that we need to be doing more, and I think that the energy bill that we crafted does so much to do that. With the energy efficiency pieces that we have, the conservation pieces, the focus on renewable energy and how we can build those energy sources that are carbon free, but to put in place some form of a cap and trade, a trading system that is not only certainly untested in this country, but I think fraught with great potential for abuse. Right now, when you look at what the House produced and how they allocated who was going to get what when it comes to the allocations, it was pretty much who was barking the loudest, because we need to get this bill passed. And if you're from the agriculture section and you're concerned about it, well, okay, how about if we give you a few more free credits? This is not how you build good policy. What they did in the House side was advanced a bill, pushed a bill, crammed a bill, but I don't believe it will yield good policy for this country, and I'm greatly concerned about it. Look at the few refineries that we have here in this state. If a cap and trade bill, some iteration of what we saw out of the House, were to pass, those three refineries would be shut down. And it's not just the refineries in Alaska. The impact to refineries throughout the country would be such. And the information is now finally coming out in publications like the Wall Street Journal and some of the other national media outlets that are saying, you know, this is not good for us. We're already a nation that is close to 70% reliant on foreign sources of oil, of the crude. But now we're going to be putting ourselves in a position where we're going to be importing the refined product as well. Talk about increasing our vulnerability. Talk about increasing our energy insecurity. This is not where we need to be going. Just from the Alaska perspective, when you look to how the politics of this legislation changed as they were trying to get additional members to come on in support. The guys from the coal-producing states came out okay. Unfortunately, they came out okay at the expense of natural gas. Well, here in this state, if we're trying to advance our natural gas, we need to be looking very carefully at what is coming down the pike. Now, I mentioned earlier the concern that exists, that is out there, about increased tax hikes to the oil and gas industry. It's a bullseye, it's very real, and it's something that we fight against with every legislative session. And I think it's only going to be a more pronounced attack this year, as we look to pay for some of the programs that that Congress and the administration are looking to advance. But I think we recognize that cutting off the hand that is helping to feed is not going to help us as a state. It's not going to help us as a nation, particularly in our national security and energy insecurity issue. The last point I might mention on energy, this goes back to ANWR because it's something that I think when we talk about those federal policies that limit us as a state, ANWR is always right up there as the number one, or if not the number one, right in the top two or three. And the real fear this year is not that, well, we're going to make a go at opening ANWR only to be beat back, but the real fear is that we'll be fighting a wilderness bill. And that, to me, is one of the greatest concerns with ANWR. I'm willing to come up with different approaches and different compromises and working with colleagues, but I have to know that I've always got the ability to do that. If it's put in wilderness, that door is shut, and we cannot have that door shut on us. I want to save, oh gosh, I got to shush up. I can't sit down without talking about healthcare, so let me just speak a little bit. As you know, I have had the opportunity to stand before probably about 2,500 Alaskans in town hall meetings from Fairbanks. I was here in Anchorage at Diamond High. We were down on the Kenai on Saturday. I was up in the valley on Friday. Had really great turnout. People are as concerned about this as a single issue as anything that I have seen since I've been in the Senate. And what is different, what's unusual, is the people that are coming out to talk. These are not folks that put the T-shirts on and go to the assembly meetings in the chambers and are participating in kind of the public process that goes on. These are people that have been raising their kids and working hard and they're following the news, and they are really concerned. They're really concerned about what they're seeing in terms of the direction that we're going with healthcare and healthcare reform. And they're worried. And they're worried for themselves. And they're coming out and they're speaking out, which I think is good. I think it's healthy. We actually had a very good discourse. And people were respectful, even though they were really differing opinions. But they were respectful, and I think that speaks well for Alaskans. But probably the three top things that I heard are the restrictions on access to primary care among Medicare patients. And we just hear that time and time and time again as I go around the state. The second is the double-digit increases in the health insurance premiums, and then the insurance denials of coverage to those with pre-existing conditions. As you know, we advanced a bill out of the Senate Help Committee earlier this summer. It was a price tag in excess of $1 trillion. It didn't allow for the level of access that I think those who had drafted it had hoped for. It set reimbursement rates at a level that, quite honestly, would do nothing to reduce the cost curve, as we've been saying. And so it was a bill that I couldn't support. If we're going to do health care reform, we must make sure that we're bringing down our health care costs and putting them on that downward trajectory. We need to make sure that the insurance reforms are real. We've got to contain the spending. When you look at it's about 75% of the individuals that are I guess the health care users, about 75% of all the health care costs are those with chronic disease conditions. They need the care. They don't get it in time. They end up in an ER. They're rushed out of state because the cases become so severe. They end up paying, we end up paying for the uncompensated care that they receive. We need to be focusing on how we manage and how we deal with those that are in this category of the chronic needs. Just from a business perspective, because we're here at the chamber, one of the things that caused me great concern about the legislation that came out of the Senate Help Bill was that, once again, you know, how do you pay for it? Who's going to be bearing the costs? And unfortunately, in the Senate bill, so much of that cost was going to be borne by the small businesses. And when you think about small businesses here in the state of Alaska. About 96.8% of the Alaskan businesses are small businesses. And I know that not all of you are doing as well as you would like to be doing. And so when you look at the kind of that hidden tax that we would be placing on small business in an effort to provide for the level of coverage, again, it's something that caused me great concern. One of the ways that I think we've got to be looking at in terms of how we reduce our costs, we've got to be able to have a conversation about tort reform. To just absolutely take it off the table and say, no, it's not even going to be part of the discussion. It belongs in Judiciary Committee as a subject of jurisdiction. You know, if we're really going to try to fix the problem, then all of the solutions need to be on the table. And when you talk to your medical providers out there, they will tell you that whether they like it or not, there is a level of defensive medicine that is being practiced, and it is real. It is tangible, and it's something that we can and should address with tort reform. Okay, I could keep going. I've got so much to talk about. Can I just not give an official ending and just move straight to questions? Is that allowable?
Yes.
Because otherwise, I will keep talking, and I have to go to St. Paul this afternoon. So let's go to questions, please.
Okay. We actually have a lot of questions.
I figured you would.
And so I'm going to try to group some of the questions together so that you can answer them. And some of them you've already talked about a little bit. There was quite a bit of questions about climate change and the defining question of our – and also I'm going to read about two or three questions and then let you answer them. The defining question of our time is how to address climate change. While there are many details to consider when the Senate takes up this question next month, will you support regulating greenhouse gas emissions, and will you support a climate bill this year? And then the cost of reducing global pollution, maybe $15 to $20 per ton of CO2, the cost of taking no action at all would be in the trillions. Either way, there are costs involved, but which course do you feel is economically preferable, taking action or not? And will you support, again, climate energy? And then I'll let you answer those two, and then we'll get on to cap and trade.
Well, I'm going to take the easy part first, because there was one that says, will you support a climate change bill this year? We are not ready for prime time this year. And I don't care whether you are a proponent or an opponent of climate change legislation. I think what we saw out of the House, and one of the reasons that the House bill is subject to so much criticism right now, is because it was really rushed through that process. There was no bipartisan give and take. It was an absolute cram down of legislation, and I think you certainly saw that evidenced itself in the final vote. You didn't have a single Republican supporting it. And whether it is health care or whether it is climate change bill, I just don't think that the solution is to say there are more of us, and so we don't even need to talk to you guys. We don't need to work through and really build good policy. We can just do what we want because we have the numbers. I don't think that that makes sense. Climate change and the approaches to a cap and trade program are such that we need to be careful in what we craft. This is not just spending money where if next year we decide we don't want to spend that money on that project or that investment, you just don't appropriate it. What we would be putting in place is a whole system, a whole new regime. To unravel this will be very difficult. And this is the same analogy that I have used with healthcare. If we're talking about healthcare reform and we're setting up a whole new system, just as we did back in 1965 when we put Medicare in place in the first place, it's not just, okay, we're not going to fund it next year if we don't like it. We can't be experimenting. We need to make sure that we're going to get this right. I had a guy stand up at the healthcare town hall in Kenai, and he says, you know, I'm an environmental engineer. Everything that I do requires years of EISs and analysis. He says, why don't you look at me as an individual, as being your project? If we're talking about healthcare, we're talking about climate change, why wouldn't you make sure that you've studied the impact on us first? That was an interesting. So I think what we need to do is be very careful. Yes, I do believe that we need to be reducing our emissions. I think we can take steps, as we have done in the energy bill, that will put us on the right track. I am not one who has said absolutely no to the concept of cap and trade. I actually signed on to a more moderate version of a cap and trade approach a couple years ago with Senator Bingaman. There were assurances in his legislation that they call them collars, basically that the price can't get too high. My concern is you put in place a regime like this, you strangle your economy, and you don't have the ability to put in place the necessary technologies that are really going to help us advance to a cleaner cleaner emissions-free environment. We got to make sure we're doing this right. So I think it's going to be some time before you're going to see a climate change bill that has a cap and trade component through the Congress.
Okay. You actually answered the next set of questions, so I'll go on to the next topic. The recent objections to horizontal drilling into ANWR seem to have more to do with any new drilling on the North Slope than with ANWR. Mm-hmm. Is this an accurate assessment? If so, how is this going to affect oil and gas development in Alaska?
Well, I think I would agree with the question. I think it is a concern that we just don't want to do anything new up there. And if, in fact, that is kind of the approach of the new administration, I think we should all be concerned. Because as we know, our pipeline, our oil pipeline, is half full. We need to be active and engaged in the exploration, and we need new activity up north. So if the attitude is going to be, whether it's ANWR or NPRA or offshore, that we don't want to encourage it and we will, in fact, discourage it, I think it is a very troubling sign for our state.
Okay. The major objections to the OCS program are not enough baseline science, not enough oil spill research and capability for ICE, and zero discharge and effect on wildlife and subsistence. What can Congress do to fix these objections?
So much of what we can do from a government's perspective is make sure that we are providing the funding so that we do have that research. It's kind of one of these catch-22s. They say you got to have the research, but then we won't help to facilitate the funding for the research. And this is true not only up north, but in the North Aleutian Basin. We say you've got to have all these studies, but then we have not, from the federal perspective, sufficiently provided for the level of research that is necessary there. There were a couple other pieces to that. Help me out.
Baseline science, zero discharge, subsistence, and just what can Congress do to fix those?
Yeah.
All right. The next set of questions have to do with healthcare, and you've answered quite a bit, but I'll try to ask a few of the specific ones. I'll ask about two or three questions here. Do you feel the healthcare reform is obtainable in the current administration and Congress? Can overall healthcare costs be significantly reduced without a public option? And what tools can government give small business so that they can help their employees get health insurance coverage? And other than that, just general questions about healthcare.
Do I think that healthcare reform can be moved through the Congress? I do. I do because I believe that we must do something within the Congress on healthcare reform. I don't think that the answer is just to kind of close our eyes and will it away, because it really is, it's big, it's overwhelming, it has constructs in it that we really don't like. As I mentioned, we're on an unsustainable path. In terms of the health care costs and just that upward curve, then you look at another graph that we shop around at these town hall meetings, and you see the Medicare funding, essentially Medicare going bankrupt by 2018. There's just a lot out there in the system that is not sustainable, and not the least of which is the impact to the individual and their family. When they're seeing double-digit increases to their premiums and they're saying, We can't, as a family, continue to provide coverage, and so we're going to run the risk. I believe we must do something. Do I believe that we will move through the Congress the same thing that moved through the Senate Health Committee? No, I certainly hope not. I think what is going to happen when we come back is you will see a scaling back. I think that the steam has somewhat been let out of the public option. I think as you've watched what's going on in the country over this past month, people have really been speaking out saying, wait a minute, we're just not convinced that this is where you need to go. I don't necessarily need more government into my health care. I really want to know that it's me and my doctor and not the government here and the insurance company over here. So I do believe that we will see something. My crystal ball is somewhat foggy in terms of what it is that we'll actually be able to advance. My hope is that we can do a couple things, and it may be that you do them in smaller bills. We've got to do something with insurance reform. And as we have talked to those within the industry, I think there's a recognition, okay, we've got to be focused on what is going on with the pre-existing conditions and the denials there. I think that there are some pieces that can be addressed legislatively. I think one of the things that we can be doing, I mentioned tort reform as a way to reduce costs. But there are things that we can be doing now that doesn't require setting up a whole new governmental system. But we pay for our health care now. When we pay our providers, it's a fee-for-services type of an approach. And, you know, when you get this shoulder worked on, we're going to pay for this. And when we go over here, we pay for this. We don't do this coordinated care. We should be working to provide for that. The provider payments in more of a you're paying for quality instead of quantity. So there are some things that we can be doing within the delivery system itself. Why are we not doing more like we see with what South Central Foundation is doing, this medical home model, where they're not only gaining great efficiencies that make the patient happier, the provider happier, but they're lowering costs for everybody else. There's some good models out there. Any of you that have ever been to the Mayo Clinic, you know that that's a different approach. Well, those providers are all paid on a salary there. It's a different environment. It's a different way of delivering, but it's actually reducing costs. Why would we not be doing more to replicate some of that? What are we doing in terms of incentives to be healthier? What we have in this country is a sick care system. We will take care of you when you are sick. But what are we doing to keep you healthy? You know, you shouldn't be paying for co-pays for your annual screenings. There are things that we can do to help reduce costs, to provide for access. And we must be dealing with a reimbursement issue for our providers as well, but without having to build a whole new system on top of a broken Medicare system.
Well, we are running out of time, and we had a lot of questions, and so we'll get to more of the questions on the website, on the Senator's website. Okay. But I thought I would leave you with one last question.
Okay.
Given all of the large spending that we've had recently, how are we going to get out of the largest U.S. deficit in history? Just a few minutes.
I think it's time for me to go to St. Paul. Now, it is the question that is at the base of everything that we're doing. When I'm talking to people in these town hall meetings, the sense that I'm getting, the anxiety, the concern is not so much that, Lisa, I hate this health care bill. It's, whoa, wait a minute. What are you guys doing there? You know, you just spent $787 billion on an economic stimulus package that may or may not be working. You bailed out Fannie, you bailed out Freddie, you bailed out AIG. Then there was the TARP funding that came in at the tune of billions. You throw in $3 billion just for cash for clunkers. You're telling me that health care reform may be $1 trillion. Oh, by the way, my 401k plan is just not what I want it to be. My son's off in college. His 529 is not what I want it to be. The value of my home, my asset, is not what I want it to be. And there, people are saying, wait a minute, all of a sudden there's a tipping point. And what are you guys in Washington doing about it? You're spending more. And you're not only spending more of my money, but you're spending my kids' money and my kids' kids' money. And this is where I think you're seeing people across the country standing up and saying, hey, hear us out, because we're worried. And we in Congress must pay attention to this. We must be working in a manner that is wise with the taxpayer dollars, because it's not as if we're just gonna cut everything off and say that the deficit has gotten too enormous for us to deal with. But we're going to be faced with some issues coming up in this next year. Some on the other side of the aisle are going to say that we need to roll back the tax cuts that we saw back in 2001, 2003, that reduced the tax cuts on the income bracket. They're going to say we need to pull those back to eliminate the budget deficits. But the real problem with the deficit is not that we're paying too little in taxes, but that we are spending too much. And the current rate of spending, I think we would agree, is unsustainable. And we have got to figure it out. Now, some of you may have read the editorial in the Daily News a couple weeks back where I was criticized for basically saying that we need to cut our costs when it comes to health care, and then I go and I issue all these press releases on what funding we got for Village Safe Water and how much we were able to save the Denali Commission training funds and as if there was I was supposed to stop doing the job that I think Alaskans have asked me to do, where when we need to advance projects that will help with our infrastructure, that's what we do. But we do it responsibly, and we do it wisely. And we work within the process. And when we decide that, well, we're just going to spend $787 billion, and we're going to do it all in a two-year period, and we're going to do it with really very little oversight, and we're going to hope that it works, as opposed to a process that I think lends for greater accountability, there's the difference there. So much of it comes back to accountability. But I will tell you, and it's not just this administration, and it's not just Democrats. Republicans and Democrats, Bush administration, Obama administration, we didn't get into this deficit situation overnight. So it's something that we've all got to be working together, because all of our kids are going to be paying. With that, I thank you for the opportunity to be here with you today and to address you. Great to be back home. Thanks.
Thank you, Lisa Murkowski.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA. This week, you heard Senator Lisa Murkowski addressing the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center. Recorded on Monday, August 31st, Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke on the impact of congressional action on the economy, and she responded to questions from the audience. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org, where you can also find links to all of the local groups featured on the show each week. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the top of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Speck. Thanks for listening.